Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer, and today I have with me my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And we have, as always, a guest today, Yang Chen, who is an associate professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at the Singapore Management University's Lee Kong Chiang School of Business. And his research primarily focuses on competition, innovation, and global strategy in the digital economy. Liang, welcome to Talking About Platforms.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Welcome from my side as well. And let's dive into the first usual question. The title is Talking About Platforms. The question is, what is a platform to you? And even to get a bit more personal, how you end up studying platforms?
Right. I guess that's a tricky question. Right. The definition is kind of fluid over the years, and people tend to have very different views. Not very different views, or slightly different views. And some people insist on their own definition. And to me, let's say digital platform, right? It's an online intermediary, connecting users with other users, with other products, with other services that are not provided or commissioned by the platform company or by the platform. And that connection used to be through searching. Right? We all search online, and now more reliant on matching by the algorithm. But anyway, it's intermediary connecting users with other stuff. And it has to be digital, therefore involving a digitalized interface and accessible only through digital devices. And it has to be a platform business model. So I don't regard Amazon's direct-to-consumer business as a platform. Amazon Marketplace, that's a different story. And I'm also sort of hesitant to call Netflix a platform. I often don't make a fuss about a definition in my class, right? I don't want to get into that debate. But I'm reluctant to call Netflix a platform. So I pivoted in my research, right? I was trained as an international business scholar, doing business economics. And then later moved on to a bit more to innovation in general. And then to platforms, more specifically. So I myself is a heavy social media user. I don't know if it's a good thing or bad thing. So I'm on social media, I don't want to say that, but many hours a day. And I play video games on consoles, and I'm not a heavy sort of hardcore gamers, but I do play games. And I have had YouTube Premium, subscription, Spotify subscription, Disney Plus, Netflix, Amazon Prime, all sorts of subscriptions. So I feel like, you know, my life was built upon platforms. And the most important thing, I guess, is my wife's job. And she's a full-time content creator on Chinese social media. And she has around 250,000 followers. So we always discuss things about platforms and the way she was like screwed by the platform, and then, you know, the policy changes on platform, governance changes on platform, what's the implication for people like her in terms of the way she draws users, the way she engages with users, the way she can monetize her content. And it's an ongoing discussion, right? So we always have this discussion and debate at home. And so I feel like my entire life is like built around platform. So it's really natural for me to do platform research.
That's a good story. And I can definitely relate. I also spend quite some time on different social media platforms and also spent quite some time gaming.
It's for research purposes, right?
Yeah, totally. Yang, you already mentioned the word governance. And I think working with platform governance and especially the interplay between the governance design or governance changes and the technical design of a platform. I think this is something that you have been working on a lot and have published some very interesting papers about, especially last year. I think two of them in the Journal of Management, where you on one look into platform governance design and platform governance design and platform ecosystems with a particular perspective on complementers, multi-homing decisions. And then another one, a literature review, where you particularly looked into or came up with a framework how governance, the design influences value creation and value capture that I very much like and that I would like to talk about a bit later. But before, what is your perspective on platform governance design? Why do you think this is something so interesting to you and such an interesting phenomenon to look into as is?
Yeah, I guess that has to do with my training, which was pretty much focused on sort of a traditional economic governance a theory of the firm, right? So market versus hierarchy sort of thing. I guess it's all about governance, right? So you govern the economic activities and you govern your partners in conducting those economic activities, whether they are within your firm or an external entity. So whether you govern this relationship through a contract or, you know, a sort of spot market exchange or a short-term, long-term contract, or through some kind of hierarchical fiat and hierarchical control. That has been the way we think about economic governance or organizational governance, economic sort of relationships between companies. And then platforms introduce a slightly different way in which they govern the relationship with complementors, with those people who operate on platforms, right? So it's neither a contract or a contract in traditional senses, nor fiat sort of hierarchical control. It's more of giving them a nudge to try to do things that you desire, but without really having the power to tell them what to do or how to do it. So that's kind of interesting to me and to my co-authors. And we're trying to understand the logics behind those governance moves and also the implications.
Can you maybe give a concrete example or one or two cases that makes it feasible for the listeners to understand this interplay between changing the rules and changing the, let's say, circumstances for complementers that are on a platform that you looked into, and maybe even act as, let's say, typical mechanisms or blueprints how platforms change or design their governance mechanisms?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of sort of incentive-based governance instruments or moves or approaches. For example, on social media, the platform company would like to, when they would like to see certain types of contents, they wouldn't create those contents by themselves. First of all, it's not within their immediate expertise. They are a platform company. They are not content creators. And also they don't have the capacity to produce so many different types of contents. but they would have some kind of vision as to, you know, at that particular point in time, we should have more, that particular types of content. So they would give specific incentives saying, okay, let's do this campaign, right? Inviting our content creators to produce certain types of content. And in return, we would give more traffic. So it's essentially a contractual relationship if you think more carefully, right? So the instead of monetary payoff, they give those content creators traffic in return, right? But in a way, you can monetize that traffic, right? You can turn that traffic into monetary returns, either through advertising revenues or through other means, right? So it can, for example, from content creators' point of view, they can direct those users to their own independent e-commerce stores, or they can, there are many ways in which you can monetize that traffic. So it's a bit like a contract, but not necessarily so, right? They don't specify what you need to create. They don't specify how you need to create it. But there are a lot of such examples on social media in particular, right? So the platform company wouldn't do it by themselves, but they would provide some kind of incentives to invite content creators to create a certain type of content with a certain theme, right? And then direct traffic to those contents. Right. They're probably not going to direct traffic to those content creators per se. Right? They don't want to create some kind of imbalance such that some content providers, content creators become too powerful or too influential on the platform, creating some kind of imbalance in bargaining power. But they will certainly direct traffic to those specific contents that they would like to see. Right, so it's not a contract. It's not a sort of fiat in traditional sense. It's more of giving them a nudge, giving them a little bit of incentive, so that they can create something that a platform would desire.
I think you are touching one of the basic mechanisms of platforms: the fact that you have to engage in value creation someone that is not traditionally, let me say, obliged to create value for your organization. You were mentioning social media that are probably one of the most interesting cases in this direction. If we think about the implication that changing the algorithm have on the content creators, on the influencers' job, and things like this. I was wondering, from your study, are there some kind of critical success factors that emerge in this in the design of this platform governance, in the engagement of this type of complementors or content creators?
Yeah, artist incentives always work. You could always argue, many of the complementors do not work for the platform, right? So they create content, so they sell products, and they do whatever on the platform. Platforms, not necessarily just for monetary returns, as some of them do like the feel of being affiliated in a community. So the identity of the community does matter to many of the complementors, the freelancers. But I think incentives and the ability for complementors to monetize their skills and the knowledge and the contents really matters a lot in many cases. And at the end of the day, it's a competition between different platforms. Right? So the ability to draw more complementors and more content creators to your platform does contribute to competitive advantage of the platform. And incentives, incentives would be a very much useful or effective way to draw those complementors, so make them switch to your platform. Despite that, in reality, many of them at the very beginning probably didn't, do that for money's sake.
I think with incentives and also talking about the different phases a platform goes through, or any organization go through, This is a good point to at least inside our heads, looking at your framework, where you say on the one hand you have the governance and you separate there between incentives and also control mechanisms, which determines the you separate between the digital design and the non-digital design. So the interfaces, SDKs, code that you provide to the complementers, and then also basically how a platform engages in the complementary ecosystem. And then you say the design and design decisions and maybe how complementers use the design reshapes how the platform governs and steers incentives and control. Give me an example how the technical and the design aspects reshape how a platform, let's say, defines and also implements incentive and control structures, and why you think that this is an area that needs to be better studied or needs more research to be better understood.
Yeah. Okay. So let me think if I can give you an example. I think in general, it's a learning process for both parties. Right? So from the platform's point of view, once they have a vision, they want to implement incentive control through certain types of design. Right? So the design on platforms. Some of which is technical, some of which is more sort of traditional in a sense. And then the complementors would respond in kind, right? So it's never really clear, you know, before that change was implemented, that the change would really work as expected. Right? So complementors always have their own interests in mind. I don't really buy the argument that sometimes people say that complementors would fight for the platform. I don't think they would fight for any platforms. They would only fight for themselves. So they would always try to find a way to take advantage of those changes to their own benefit. Right? And sometimes they can game the system, exposing the loopholes in those governance or design changes. And then the platform would again respond to fill those loopholes. And sometimes, you know, the collective behaviors of the complementors is not something the platform can anticipate or fully figure out at the start, right? And so there might be some dynamics between the complementors. They might share knowledge between each other. Right. And they get to understand the implication of those policy changes or design changes by the platform better, so that they would want to get around those restrictions, right? Sometimes game the system. So it's a sort of a recursive process, right? They learn from each other's behaviors and they learn the implications of those changes in policy and changes in design. At the end of the day, it's all about maximizing their own benefits, right? So I don't buy the argument. Sometimes people do argue, right? I was recently reading a paper trying to argue, you know, when there is a new entrant in the platform market, the complementors of the existing platform would put in more effort and would try to serve their users better, for example, right, to sort of fight against the entrant platform. I don't think that's the case. Those complementors would only work in the best of interest interest of themselves. It's the same when they have to, you know, fight against the platform's policy changes, the design changes. And I think that's the really interesting bit. My wife always say that she's feeling screwed by the platform. And if you think about it, right, so intensive change or design change, sometimes to incentivize complementors to put in more effort to create higher quality content, to create content in a particular area. And that contract is not subject to safeguards, right? So the content creators do not have a very high level of contractual safeguards. And once you put in the effort, and sometimes the effort is kind of specific to that audience, specific to that platform, right? So you're fully exposed to the platform firm's opportunism. Exposed, right? So once you put in the effort, then, you know, they can do whatever they like. So you always feel it's not just the power imbalance. It also has to do with a lack of contractual safeguards.
I think a quick comment to that. I think you have a very, very relevant point looking at or trying to better understand what are often called platform co-ops or platform cooperatives, where basically the platform, the idea is that the platform is owned by the complementers and the users. And when you now say that the complementers optimize particularly for themselves, I think for the co-ops in the beginning, when you have these more idealistic groups, small group of people who want to build something together, they have the bigger picture probably still in mind and can balance design decisions, design changes, governance decisions, governance changes. And because these are the same actors that occupy both sides, they can manage this within a realm of actors who have, like, let's say, a bigger picture in mind. But the moment these co-ops grow, and this is, I think, why there are so few cases that have a decent size or a bigger size, the moment these co-ops grow, the number of actors that mainly optimize for themselves and then are in this conflict of designing something for the greater good while optimizing for themselves, in this intersection between how do I change the rules, how do I change the design, this is a very, I think, interesting field of tension, and maybe adds to that field as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There was this debate, you know, among practitioners. I think it's a long-lasting discussion about the tension between platforms and complementors in terms of private and public traffic. From the platform owner's point of view, they're always trying to create a larger pool of public traffic, right? So the public traffic is to draw users onto the platform, whereas the complementors always try to direct or take a share of that traffic to convert it into private traffic, such that these users or their followers become more loyal to the complementors, regardless of which platform they access to interface or consume the content of that content creator. They tend to multi-home, right? They tend to multi-home for different purposes. And at the end of the day, they will try to find a platform where they can monetize their content the most. And that doesn't have to be the original platform where they really took off. So complementors really trying to convert all those public traffic into private traffic. There comes the tension between platform owners and complementors, right? Despite, on the face of it, they are co-creating value. We always tend to say, right, they're co-creating value. But there's a lot of tension there, actually. And one of the key principle, as I observe for many social media platforms, is to balance out the number of content creators across all the domains or verticals. All right, so you might have some celebrities, or some, you know, sports related contents, video game related contents, life, lifestyle, travel, everything. Right, try to balance it out rather than, you know, tilt the data traffic to any specific category or to any specific content creator. So they are curating the portfolio of content and try to make sure that traffic stays with, you know, at the public level, rather than directing to the private pool. And I don't think that's something, you know, we've studied enough in academia.
Well, there is another aspect in the perspective that you have on platforms that I think it would be very interesting to explore with you, which is the global dimension of platforms. We know you have a HBR piece that is titled Three Obstacles to Globalizing a Digital Platform. And I was wondering if you'd like to share with us something about it.
Yeah, so because I was doing a lot of international business research, right, and then later pivoted to platforms. So marrying these two areas together really makes sense for me. And again, I still think that's an understudied area. But if you look at those platforms that we're familiar with, or we've heard of, they're mostly happy international operations. Some of them are more sort of interconnected operations across countries, right, operate at a global level. Some of them are more sort of fragmented at each location. Like those ride sharing companies, right? So they have operations at a city level, basically. So in a way, that's determined by the business model. So some companies might inherently facing a high barrier to international expansion simply because they couldn't leverage the network effects cross border. Some of them operate at a more global level, but you also would have the challenge of having to sort of curate contents for audience that comes from a very different backgrounds. So that's a challenge for TikTok. And different countries, for example, have different institutions, have different laws, have different views, have different political views, right? And of course, algorithm would help, right, in pushing contents to countries, to certain countries, and to audience in certain countries, such that there is a match between the audience and the content, taking into consideration, you know, geographic differences, political differences, preference differences, so on and so forth. And that's a challenge for platforms, right? It used to be a challenge for multinational companies, but platforms are more exposed to that challenge, but also better, more capable of using algorithms to sort of get around those challenges. And there's another example, right? Shein, the fast fashion clothing company. Again, I'm reluctant to call it platform, but it is now pivoting to a platform model, opening up to third-party sellers to try to broaden the number of SKUs and broaden the types of products being sold on the platform. Right, so it's gradually adopting a platform business model. So those fast fashion platforms, or even like social media like TikTok, they don't know much about international markets. They don't know much about the preferences of those local users in a foreign country. Right, so they rely very heavily on algorithm in telling them, you know, what would be the sort of contents and what would be the sort of products that users or consumers from a certain country would desire. And that comes in very handy, because if you think about a traditional multinational companies, they need to have an office there. They need to hire local people to be able to understand the sort of intricacies of the culture and you know, what it means for product development, what it means for distribution channels, what it means for marketing. and sales campaigns. Now those platforms rely on algorithm, and there are pros and cons, right? Algorithm is not fully transparent, so you don't know when it's gonna cause you trouble. And also, by outsourcing in a way to those algorithms, you lose the capability of really learning about the market. So there are pros and cons, but that's really something that is unique to platforms. Again, because of the digital interface, because of the use of algorithm in matching, matching users with contents, matching users with products and services. And that's not something that traditional multinational companies did. And that's something really fascinating.
You know, talking about the global dimension of platforms, there is a topic that's always fascinated me, which is somehow the geographical influence that regulators, well, the geographical influence on regulation of platforms, meaning that we see different tendency to enter or not to enter in how platforms work. Have you observed something like that in your studies? Do you have some kind of opinion on this? Where do you think we are heading in terms of regulation of this type of mechanisms?
So the regulations on, I lost you a bit.
On the regulation, on the impact that the regulator has on how these platforms can actually operate, the limitations that they may have. Also, you know, we were talking about the contractual, not contractual dimension. That's a topic that is being treated, that is being managed in different ways. So I was wondering if you observe something about this in your studies.
Sure. Yeah, I wish for as much variation as possible, right? So we get to do the studies, get to utilize those natural experiments, so to speak. And there used to be a lot of variation, right? Even for, you know, some cities in Europe, I'm sure you're aware of that. They banned Airbnb, right? And even here in Singapore, there was no Airbnb. And in this, some other areas and other regions and other countries, they forced platforms to treat those complementals as employees. Right? These are two biggest issues. Again, of course, there are all sorts of other regulations, for example, regarding the IP protection on platform. In some countries, it is more strict. Some other countries, more lax. But I guess over time, those regulations or the way regulators look at platforms will start to emerge. It's like dominant design in traditional industries. As of now, platform is still not really a mature business model. A lot of changes and always new design, new policy, trying it out, see which one works. From the platform's point of view, right, from the business point of view, but do we fully understand the implications for complementors? Do we fully understand the implications for innovation? Do we fully understand the innovation for consumers? Not there yet, right? We're not there yet. But over time, I believe a dominant design will emerge. There's also a sort of spillover of the way regulators look at those platforms, you know, from one country to another. And I guess that would also, we will also see more sort of spillover. You know, for example, one particular platform business model gaining legitimacy in one country, you know, that sort of legitimate image might spill over to another country. So I would expect more convergence than divergence. But from research point of view, we would always like to see divergence and variations for us to study.
Yeah, I think this is super interesting also in light of comparing, let's say, more global versus more local network effects, right? The typical comparison, the Uber business model, where they have to expand city by city. You need to onboard the drivers. You need to onboard the passengers, while Airbnb naturally grows on a more on a more global level with the network effects, while the local context is probably as diverse as it is for Uber, right? So Airbnb is regulated differently in different cities and different countries. And I like the dominant design perspective and that. And then really asking the question, is it kind of the local regulation that impacts how a company that benefits from global network effects has to change their whole business model according to like emerging regulation that affects the local level, while a company like Uber that has more local effects can stay a bit more diverse because they have these decentralized ecosystems. You know what I'm referring to? I think this is
a really interesting point. Yeah, I completely get that. So in a sense that, I'd agree, in a sense that it gives Uber a little bit more flexibility in designing its platforms, even in designing the business model, right? So there was there used to be a company called Fasten in Boston, right? So there was a latecomer to the market trying to challenge Uber and Lyft. So instead of taking commission in the transaction, they only took a fixed fee. They charged a fixed fee to the drivers. There's also a similar case here in Singapore called Tada. It's a latecomer and trying to challenge Gojek and Grab. So they only charge a fixed fee to the drivers. They don't take any commission, right? And Uber would face all sorts of different types of competitors, right? So coming to the market with a different business model, trying out, see if we can take a little bit more business from Uber, we can challenge this position. Whereas a platform like Airbnb is more constrained in its capacity to implement those changes, because it needs a more consistent business model and also a more consistent image. That's a really interesting point. I don't think that's researched well in the community.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Now, looking towards the future of platforms and of your research on platforms, would you like to share with us something on what's coming, on what's on your list right now, what you're working on, what you think can be relevant in the months or years to come?
Yeah, I think overall, decentralized platform would be the way forward. And there is a lot of discussion here in this part of the world, right? Hong Kong and Singapore, really try to build themselves as a front runner in Web3. But I'm not an expert on that, so I leave that to other experts. Another direction is, globalization. We'll talk about that, right? So Temu and Shein and TikTok, they're all exploring the platform business model in fast fashion, in e-commerce in general, and we will be seeing a closer marriage between platforms and traditional supply chains. The previous generation of platform research is mostly like platform, it's all digital. But we're really starting to see a closer integration between the digital interface and the offline facilities and supply chains. That also reminds me of the recent discussion I had with our DBA students. So we had a We have a very successful DBA program here at SMU. So we had a dinner event. So a lot of students coming from China, and most of them actually. So they are entrepreneurs and business owners, very high profile. So most of them actually doing business in the digital space, and many of them are working on or already having very successful products in terms of industry platform. So this is really when industry platform is starting to take off, like facilitating the trading of agricultural products between wholesalers and retailers and between wholesalers and the government in real time. And that also connects with the futures market. And there's a lot of such industry platforms happening. And it's still elusive from a research point of view, right? We don't have enough data on that. But we will be start working with those entrepreneurs and business owners to try to understand better those industry platforms and B2B platforms and see, you know, how are they different from consumer platforms, the social media, video games, the previous generation, you know, upon which the previous generations of platform research is based. And finally, I've been doing a fair amount of AI research recently, because of its importance in general, because of its importance in platforms. Right. So we are trying to, for example, in one of the projects, we're trying to understand data-driven learning a bit better, or also called data network effects. Right. So we've understood classic network effects well enough, but now there's this new trend. Right. So users hop on board a platform not only because of the opportunity to engage with other users, but also because of the learning benefits. Right. And the more users a platform has, the more insights the platform can gather from those users and turn it into more customized products for them, also for potential adopters. So we all know it's different from classic network effects, but we don't really have a very clear idea as to what exactly it is and how it may influence platform strategy and how it may influence competitive outcomes. So in that paper, we discussed things like learning efficiency, a learning curve. It could be increasing at a decreasing rate. It could be exponential, so on and so forth. It depends on the exact market. It depends on the technical capabilities of the platform. And you can imagine there are some platforms are more capable of developing algorithms and matching users with useful contents. So it obviously also depends on the number of users a platform has, but in a different way as classic network effects. And we'll also discuss things like cross-individual learning and within individual learning. And you can imagine within individual learning would increase switching costs for those users. And we'll also discuss things like the decay of data, right? So in those pattern study, right, in traditional innovation studies, we talk about decay, right? So the decay of those knowledge embodied in the patterns. And it's the same on platforms, and so on and so forth. We try to model the dynamics between an incumbent and an entrant based on data-driven learning instead of the strength of network effects. So that's one of the ongoing projects. I also look at AI in general, its impact on knowledge searching patterns by knowledge workers, its role in biotech firms' innovation process. So for example, is AI only improving efficiency in searching? Is it as capable in deep search as in wide search? Does it help improve creativity? Sort of finding recombination of components that is hard to identify by human intelligence. So along those lines, organizational learning, knowledge searching, those innovation related topics, through the lens of AI.
Yang, you mentioned so many interesting topics that trigger lots of potential follow-up questions for me. But unfortunately for now, we reached the end of this episode of our time together today. But I already see that this was hopefully not your last appearance on the podcast and that we can then have you back on to talk about one of these super interesting other topics that you have on your roadmap and that you are working on. You also mentioned that you're active on social media. So before we close, if listeners want to follow your upcoming work or maybe also get in touch, what is the best way to stay up to date about what you're doing?
I'm still on LinkedIn. I tried to cut back on my time on social media, but I'm still on LinkedIn. I'm actually using LinkedIn for my strategy class. So I ask my students to pair up and post contents on LinkedIn about whether AI can create competitive advantage, about how useful a subscription business model is under what circumstances it is more useful than not, so on and so forth, right? So I ask them to fully utilize professional social media and post contents and increase visibility. So I'm still on LinkedIn for pedagogical and research purposes.
Very good. We will for sure link this, your profile, in the show notes. And with that, I can only thank you so much for your time, Yang. This was great, great talking to you. I think we touched a broad set of very, very interesting topics. You provided us very, very good insights about your thinking around governance design and platforms in general. So thank you so much. Hope to have you back on, and just the best for your future research projects.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me, Philip and Daniel. Yeah, hope to speak to you on another occasion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.